We're very happy today to have Kim Berghaus here visiting virtually. Kim recently graduated from Johns Hopkins and she's now doing her postdoc at Stony Brook. And she's gonna tell us about thermal friction during inflation. Kim, whenever you're ready, you can go.
Christina, thanks so much for the introduction and thanks for the invitation. I'm excited to virtually be here and to tell you guys about thermal friction and early cosmology. My talk today has three main parts, and really they are mostly independent. In the beginning, in the first part, I will introduce a mechanism which I call the dissipative axion. And in the second and third part of the talk, I will be applying this mechanism to specific cosmological scenarios, one being inflation and one being the Hubble tension. And this is based on collaboration that I've been doing with David Kaplan, Peter Graham regarding inflation, and with Tanvi Karwal, who's a postdoc at UPenn for the Hubble tension. So to get started, let's first talk about the role that scalar fields play in cosmology. And then let's take a look at what happens when you throw thermal friction into the mix. So historically, rolling scalar fields have been quite popular, have been invoked quite popularly across all different cosmological timescales from the very beginning up to the very end. So now let's take a look at why that is. Rolling scalar fields have a special property in that they're able to form an energy component in our universe that exhibits negative pressure. If you have a rolling scalar field that is rolling very slowly, with that meaning that the kinetic contribution is much, much smaller than the potential contribution. And if you have such an energy component and it is dominant and has negative pressure, then you can be in a period of accelerated expansion. And this is why rolling scalar fields have been a popular mechanism to try to describe such a period. But in order for us to get this period of accelerated expansion, we need a field that is rolling very slowly. So what is responsible for the field rolling slowly? We need to have a friction mechanism. And the regular picture that we have, I've written down here the equation of motion of the scalar field, is that it's rolling down its potential and it's experiencing Hubble friction, where Hubble friction just means that our universe itself is expanding and we're losing energy to this expansion itself. And this is all quite well understood, but now you may ask, it's a natural extension to ask, what if we make this more complex? For example, what if we couple the scalar field itself not only gravitationally, but also what happens if we couple it to other particles. So, and in particular, what happens if we couple it to light particles? Is it possible for us to turn on a coupling in our Lagrangian, where I here have this J-in term as a general coupling term, where light degrees of freedom live in that term? And is it then possible for us to extract energy from the rolling field and dump it into radiation bath in a way in which you can maintain a temperature? And keep in mind that this is quite challenging because we are expanding acceleratedly. So even if we put something in, it's diluting. So if you want to maintain a temperature, you need to put the radiation in your background quite efficiently. And what you would ideally want in this equation of motion, you can treat this thermal friction. You can just phenomenologically write it down. You can say, oh, let's take this and extract energy and let's dump it into the thermal bath. But as particle physicists, we want this to be emergent behavior. We want to have our Lagrangian term and we want to have this friction come out of the coupling itself. So now let's take a look at what requirements we need to fulfill to have such a setup. And to do that, let's go back to the basics. And what I've written down here as a reminder in the upper right corner is the Euler-Lagrangian equations. And here we can see we have our equation of motion. And now we're adding this interaction term. And it's linear in phi. And peeking at the Euler-Lagrangian equations, we can say, okay, then the term that should appear in this equation of motion should be linear in this J interaction term. And this is exactly what I've written down here, but you can see that it has a quite peculiar form. So I will explain why I've written it down this way. The term that appears is the expectation value with respect to the thermal background And now I have the subscript non-equilibrium. What that means is that we're looking for the expectation value of this interaction term in the presence of the coupling between the interaction term and the phi field. So this isn't probably a way of writing that you haven't seen before, and maybe a way of thinking about this that you haven't seen before, is that there the presence of the coupling itself introduces a difference here. Now the question is, this unusual object, how can we calculate it? And luckily, if our background evolution is slowly, so if phi evolves very slowly compared to the scale in which our plasma is interacting, in that scenario, we can expand this term, this expectation value that we need to calculate. We can expand it as a series of phi and phi dot that has coefficients out front. And I've labeled these coefficients here very suggestively. The term that's in front of the linear phi term, I've labeled that the thermal mass contribution, because this is exactly the contribution that we're obtaining. Basically, you renormalize the mass of your phi field due to the presence of the thermal bath around it. And the second term here, we see that here we have exactly the type of friction coefficient that we phenomenologically put into the equation of motion previously.
Yeah, may I ask you a question? So it seems to me that you are expanding in phi, like Taylor expanding in phi. So you are assuming that phi is probably small. So I wonder what is the assumption here? I mean, small compared to what?
I'm assuming that phi dot is small. And
phi dot, I agree. I agree with that. No, but you also write just linear coupling to the current, right? So in principle, I could imagine this coupling could be a nonlinear function of phi. Well, the same as the potential is nonlinear function of phi.
No, not quite. So it's not that you do, in this expansion, there are no higher order terms in phi. There's no phi squared or phi cubed. The only terms that exist, this is a function that depends on phi, but it depends on phi as it is evolving in time, which is why in the first order term here, you're keeping phi dot, and then you would need to keep higher terms in the time evolution of phi if it wasn't slow. But the condition that we're fulfilling here that allows us to make this expansion is that the time scale at which phi is evolving is small compared to the plasma interaction scale. So the scale at which our radiation lives in this J-in term, in this interaction term, and radiation is interacting with itself in order to constantly thermalize itself. And that has a scale associated with it. And that interaction, that constant thermalization needs to be fast compared to the evolution of phi. So that we can...
But I'm probably asking rather about the first term. So you are writing the thermal mass. The expression for a J-in interaction, yeah? Averaged. So writing the linear term in phi, which is proportional to the thermal mass, why there are no terms phi square, phi cube, at least corrections to that, or... Yeah, so I'm asking, I'm not asking about higher time derivatives or this type of terms, but rather higher powers of phi. I don't know if it's important for what you are gonna say, but nevertheless, it still looks to me that you are assuming that phi is small compared to something.
No, you're not making the assumption that phi is small, because the full operator that you're expanding, you're coupling to phi as a function of t, linearly.
Okay.
There don't exist higher order terms in phi, because you're only linearly coupling to.
That's your assumption. Okay, so in other words, you are saying, okay, so you are assuming that there are no other couplings, but just linear. Because I could couple quadratically also. So that's kind of your restriction. That's what you are saying.
I'm taking my phi and I'm linearly coupling to whatever lives in my thermal bath, so to say. Okay. If you have a more linear setup, so I guess you can consider your Lagrangian having phi squared terms coupling to light degrees of freedom.
Right, that's what I was thinking about. Okay, I see your point. Okay, thank you.
I think that, I don't see it yet. It seems to me there's two approximations that are going on here. One of which is you took your interaction, you took the coupling phi times j, but then you differentiated to get something on the right hand side, which where you had j, and you're saying it's a function of phi, so that you're saying that the state that is being described by the expectation value knows about the expectation value of phi. And it sounds like because you've allowed that to happen, you're really saying that there are interactions that were beyond something linear in phi. So in principle, it sounds like there really is an expansion in powers of phi that you should be doing. And it might be true that you did neglect them, but it sounds like it's not like it was automatic that the last line was linear in phi, given that the first line was linear in phi, right? That's one approximation, but it seems like there's another approximation. You're using a mean field approximation here because you're, in general, if you have some sort of a thermal thing, it won't even be true that you can describe the effects of a generic system just in terms of changes to a Hamiltonian, for example. I don't know if that's going to be important what you're going to do. So probably what I should do now is shut up, but it sounds like that there are approximations going on. It's not a trivial approximation to say that things are linear in phi in this last line of yours. Would you agree?
I mean, it's not a trivial step, but I believe in the way that I've written it, where I've only considered a linear coupling to a generic interaction term. I do think that under that assumption, this expansion captures all of the relevant terms.
But if that were true, if that were literally all there was to it, then in your middle line here, where you've got phi dot dot plus something, the right hand side would be phi independent in that case, right? So the reason that it depends on phi is that you're imagining. I probably we should wait to see what you do actually later on. But your expectation value here, it'll depend on what you mean by that. But they can depend on phi because there were interactions that were that system, whatever it was, knew about what phi was doing. And it can't be true that j was literally a constant, in which case it wouldn't really matter. There wouldn't be any phi dependence on the right-hand side.
Is it possible that you're assuming from the action phi squared coupling to the light degrees of freedom, and then because phi is the background, then you're taking just the expectation on the light degrees of freedom. Then if I do vary that action, then that kind of gives us this kind of interaction. Right, then if I really put in a phi squared with all the other couplings to other fields, which are light degree of freedom, then I get a phi, linear in phi, and then expectation values and everything else is expected, because that's a long range and the other ones are light field. Gives me that, or
maybe we can see the completion, and so that we move on and we don't get stuck here, because we still don't see the model. So maybe after we see the model, it's going to become a bit more clear. We don't just stop you here forever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also happy to come back to this and answer more questions about it. The reason why I'm showing this expansion here in this form is in this limits is to make a following point. This is the object that we have on the right hand side. So we can see that it is possible generically to get this this friction coefficient that it extracts energy from our rolling field. But we do not only get this coefficient, we also get this term linear in phi here, we get this mass correction. And in fact, it is in this expansion, this is the first order term, and this is in a sense the second order term. So we do not only get the friction coefficient, we also get this this mass correction. And what becomes possible by us using this expansion is that we can actually now calculate those coefficients out front as functions of the equilibrium expectation value of our interaction. And by doing that, now we've removed this pesky non-equilibrium interaction where we also have to worry about phi, but instead we're able to actually calculate what those coefficients are just in terms of our J-int operator. And maybe a more intuitive way to think about it that we may be more used to is that if we are in the presence of a thermal bath, then previously we renormalized our field, our mass term with respect to the vacuum, but now we need to renormalize with respect to our thermal background. And this is exactly this contribution, this thermal mass contribution that you are obtaining. And we know that the only scale on the problem really, aside from couplings, is going to be the temperature. So this mass correction scales with the temperature. And we can see that this higher, the other term, the friction term, that we're trying to really obtain, that term scales with a higher order correlator of our equilibrium expectation values. And actually a very profound result is that this dissipation coefficient is inherently tied to fluctuations in our system. This is actually something that Albert Einstein, when he first analyzed Brownian motion, is something that he said, that the dissipation itself has a very intimate connection with the fluctuations in our system. So the next step that I want to take is ideally for us to have our setup where we have a friction and we extract all the energy, but we do not necessarily want to modify our potential. And this is exactly what this thermal mass term does. It's a contribution to our phi prime term in a way that, for example, if we're trying to use this model for inflation, can lead to a lot of issues. So ideally, if we pick our interaction term here, we want an interaction term where we do not get this mass contribution, or we want it to be infinitely smaller than this friction term. And as I mentioned, this friction coefficient is intimately related to fluctuations. And this leads me to introducing my model, where we will see we have a very interesting source of fluctuation that make this friction large. So I want you to consider now our interaction term to be the regular axion term. So now our phi field, the scalar field itself, is an axion, and we're coupling to a GG dual type term of a pure non-abelian gauge group. And the temperature scale that we're at is much, much larger than the confining scale of the group. So the gauge bosons are not confined, they're all free, and the gauge bosons themselves, they're now what we consider the radiation bath. And I would like to remind you that a non-abelian gauge group has a non-trivial vacuum structure. And usually we do not worry about that because any effects that would arise from that at zero temperature, they're highly suppressed because all we could do is tunnel to a different vacuum. Here I'm showing it in this picture. You may be familiar with that we denote these different vacua with a different Chern-Simons number, so to speak. And we cannot smoothly go from one degenerate vacuum to the other one. There are large barriers between them at zero temperature. But now we're considering a system where we have a large temperature. And what happens then is this is that we are able to transition between these different vacua just classically because we have enough energy to overcome these barriers. So as a consequence, this type of system at high temperatures has large fluctuations in the Chern-Simons number itself. And this fluctuation, it's a non-perturbative effect. So this effect really only exists due to the existence of all these different vacua, which exist due to the inherent vacuum structure of a non-abelian gauge group. So as I've mentioned before, is that we get a dissipative coefficient that arises from fluctuations in our system. And here we have a quantity that has large fluctuations due to this non-perturbative effect. And because it's a non-perturbative effect, it's also not not easy to calculate with pen and paper, but this rate, exactly this Chern-Simons number fluctuation rate, has been calculated on the lattice. And using that result, we are able to deduce how this friction coefficient exactly scales as a function of the variables here, where we scale with alpha to the fifth, where alpha is the coupling of the gauge group, and then t cubed to the f squared. And you may have been able to just guess the t cubed over f squared on basis of dimensional analysis, but you can really see the non-perturbative nature coming in here with the alpha to the fifth instead of like an alpha squared term. So this type of coupling gives rise to a large friction. And now you may ask, what about mass corrections? And
before you do that, can I is the statement that if I had a thermal gas of a gauge field, that this particular source of friction is the biggest source of friction, or is it one of other, you know, possibly other contributions to gamma? But it's interesting because it's going to contribute because it violates some selection rule that the other things might not have contributed to.
Are you asking what happens if we have an entire array of interaction terms?
No, I'm just wondering that there's if we didn't have this vacuum structure and we just had a gas of gluons or something, probably there's also friction there too. Is there, or is the idea that the friction would have been zero if we didn't have this vacuum structure, or is it that this is the biggest source of friction, or is it this is the biggest source of friction that contributes to a particular selection rule you're going to tell us about later on?
No, so for non-abelian group where this vacuum structure exists, this is the only, this is the only friction that exists, and it's large comparatively.
So if I had a gas of photons or something coupled to phi, you're saying there would not have been any effect?
That is a very, very interesting question. So if you have a U1, this effect in this form does not exist. So you do not have this type of friction. For U1s, people have considered also this axion type term, and that leads to a very interesting different scenario where people look at tachyonic instabilities, where you're also able to then dump energy into photons, but that looks very different. That setup is quite distinct from this one.
So why you cannot dump energy into gluons here by the same mechanism?
Because the tachyonic instability comes, you stabilize it through in a non-abelian group because your gauge bosons interact with one another, unlike the photons. And by doing that, you shut off the instability that you could try to exploit in a U1 system.
I mean, I think there is friction just from axion gluon scattering. So you have a gluon background and then there's just axion gluon scattering. You can just draw a diagram with an axion, gluon, 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 axion, right? And that's like collisions of the axion with the gluon background. And probably that leads to friction. I don't know if it's bigger or smaller.
No, you're 100% right. You can ask, now what lives in this thermal bath? And you're right, if you're sourcing gluons or gauge bosons, then you can also thermalize the axion, for sure. So you have an abundance of axions that live in your thermal bath. But we're asking here, what is the friction coefficient that shows up in your background equation of motion of the scalar field? And and what does that coefficient look like?
Is the power of alpha going to make a difference? Because it's very plausible that whatever is going to happen, it's going to go down like 1 over f squared, and on dimensional grounds, it's probably t cubed. So if the power of alpha doesn't matter, then it probably doesn't matter. Is it going to be important that you got it from this particular Sphaleron kind of a picture? Or
I mean, it is important in the sense of that everything I've been talking about is valid in the weak coupling limit. So we need to be, our gluons really need to be free. So we're looking at alphas that are smaller than about 0.1 or so. So basically putting in that largest possible value that's already 3 orders of magnitude. And that will tell you about your parameter space, so to say. But more importantly, I guess it tells you about what the underlying dynamics is that is happening here. You could try to just say, oh, it's T. Through this picture, we can obtain an understanding of what exactly gives rise to the friction and how does that friction change if we change our system slightly. I don't know, did that answer your question?
I'm just wondering, you know, because it sounds like there's a lot of things going on in that bath, but when push comes to shove down the road in your talk, is it all you care about is that gamma goes like t cubed, or is it going to matter? Is the size of the coefficient important in what you say later?
Yeah, it's gonna be important because this scale here f, it's not an arbitrary scale in a sense, right? It's the symmetry breaking scale here that our axiom term arose from. So if we take a look at the full model and we look at what numbers make sense, it matters a lot that you have an alpha fifth out front here, because it will tell you about where your theory lives.
Thank you.
So now you may ask about what about the mass term that I went to all this trouble to show you before? Do we have that too? And the answer is that for this type of term, for this axion term, the axion, we can think of it as a Goldstone boson of a broken U1 symmetry. And as such, it's protected and it does not get a perturbative thermal mass contribution. Now you may ask if there's a non-perturbative contribution, and the answer to that is yes, but it's very small at high temp. It's very small and it gets even smaller at high temperatures. So it's completely subdominant, and all we're left with is this large phenomenological friction coefficient. It's that we can match onto the friction coefficient previously that we wanted. Okay, and this concludes the first talk part of my talk, where I'm introducing the mechanism. And the main takeaway here is that this dissipative axion system produces a large friction without any other unwanted side effects. And now I'll be going into what happens if we apply that to inflation. And to do that, I'll first talk about why we care about inflation, and then what happens in the scenario where inflation gets warm. Okay. So why do we think inflation happened? What I'm showing here is a map of the cosmic microwave background from 2018. And what I'm showing here is a temperature map. And we can see very small deviations, but those are of the order of 10 to the negative 4.5. And what we can see here is that if we look in the sky and we look in all different directions, we see almost exactly the same temperature everywhere. Similarly, we measure the curvature of our universe and we measure that it's flat to a very high degree. And if there was no period of accelerated expansion in our past, then there would have different patches across the sky would have not been in thermal contact and in causal contact. So there would be no reason for them to all have the same temperature. But if we assume that there was a period of accelerated expansion, about 60 E-folds or so, that would put all these different patches into causal contact, and it could explain what we're observing today. It could also explain why the universe is so flat. So this is why inflation is very popular. And now if we look at how do we exactly model that with slow roll inflation, the idea is that we exactly have a scale field that rolls down a potential, and we have fluctuations in that field. And those fluctuations are what source the small anisotropies that we've seen. And slow roll inflation then predicts an almost scale invariant CMB power spectrum, where here I'm showing the power spectrum, which has an amplitude, which I'm showing here in blue. And it has it shows you how it changes with scale. If NS minus one was exactly zero, then it would be exactly scale invariant. But we see here a small change. And in slow roll inflation, it's the inflaton field fluctuations that scale with the power spectrum. And the only scale that exists in the setup is Hubble. So they are roughly proportional to Hubble squared. And Hubble squared itself depends on the potential. And in slow roll inflation, we're saying that the potential itself changes only very, very slowly. Therefore, you're able to get an almost scale invariant CMB power spectrum. So now warm inflation does something that is dramatically different, because now the fluctuation that we have in our inflaton field is no longer a thermal fluctuation, but is no longer a quantum fluctuation like it was before, but it becomes a thermal fluctuation. And the idea is that we have this friction, And now we have more than only the equation of motion of the scalar field. We have a second equation here, which dictates the evolution of our radiation bath. And we're seeing here that the friction exactly takes the energy and dumps it into the radiation. And after a while, this reaches a steady state where the friction continuously extracts exactly the same amount of energy that is redshifted away. So you're maintaining a steady state temperature. And if that steady state temperature, and this is exactly where our alpha to the fifth here comes back in, you can solve for what the steady state temperature is. And if that ends up being bigger than Hubble, then really your thermal effects are dominant. You have a well-defined temperature and your dynamics are slightly different. And you may ask, okay, everything about this sounds awfully specific. You put the coupling in here and this, that, but this is actually very generic. So if you do have this, this axion-like coupling, which is a quite natural coupling to consider, then this is an attractive solution. So no matter what your initial conditions are, you end up in the system where you have your steady state temperature. And if that steady state temperature is larger than Hubble, then you're dominated by thermal effects. And then now—
may I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
So how do you get the potential for this inflaton? What gives it potential? Because, well, because you are saying that you assume that it's a Gaussian boson, so I mean that makes it, that forbids unwanted couplings also to the bath.
That's
you need to give potential. Yeah.
That's a very good question. So because you're at high temperature, you cannot use the non-perturbatively generated potential of the axion because it's at a too low scale. So you do need to put in, so to say, a UV potential for this field that you could put in by, let's say, explicitly breaking your U1. And you're exactly right in that regime, then you're not exactly a Goldstone boson. You are being a pseudo Goldstone boson. But this explicit breaking that you need to do in order to put in a potential is still small. So you're still able to suppress whatever mass thermal type mass contribution you would get.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Since you've been stopped, can I ask you something too? So I know that when Arjun Barrera first came out with warm inflation, immediately there was a fight with Linde and everybody saying that things will redshift too fast. And so in your equations here, the middle one seems like it's the key one because it's saying that the radiation density is given in terms of phi dot squared, and that's how you're going to get your trade-off to work. Can you kind of motivate that equation a little bit? I was expecting that rho dot would be the thing that would see the gamma phi dot squared. Oh, I see you've already done that. I've missed the slide.
So this is the full set of equations, and then you can ask after some time what happens, which state do you be in?
After a long time,
you find that that you're no longer changing the temperature and you're in a steady state.
So in that case, the thing that takes, so the picture there is that not that rho is constant, but that everybody's evolving in time at a constant rate or something like that. Is that right? But rho dot, I guess, is negligible be compared to H rho.
Could you say that again?
In the next slide, you drop the rho dot. So it sounds like the argument is that rho dot will be smaller than H rho.
Exactly.
And so I'm trying to reconstruct what the Linde argument was, because he was making at the time they were making very strong. I know that it's not clear that they were right, but I remember it was strongly phrased.
I know exactly what paper you're referring to, and this is why I tried to carefully introduce this model.
Can you remind us what the objection was and kind of what happens?
Yeah, so this paper from over 20 years ago, it says, is warm inflation possible? And what they're doing is they consider an array of different terms, mostly straightforward terms. So they're coupling directly to scalars or directly to fermions. And what they always find is that you get a mass contribution that is dominant. And when you then have that mass contribution that is dominant, you find yourself in trouble because then your potential becomes temperature dominated. You're no longer in accelerated expansion. And then you can consider different limits, but your problem always ends up being that you get this other term that is really large that you have to worry about. But through this model, through this dissipative axiom model that I introduced, I've shown why we have a large friction and why we're able to avoid the mass contribution.
I see. So you're saying that their important objection was the shape of the potential would have changed in addition to the friction, and what's evading in your story that objection is that you're not changing the potential as far as you're concerned to the accuracy that you need.
Exactly.
I see. Okay, thank you.
So also ask a question. So let's say like I don't have a thermal bath and I have that coupling, as the scalar is rolling, I generate a non-zero E dot B, right?
A non-zero what?
E dot B, some like electric field of like this non-abelian gauge group times the B field. So here, like, is there like also a somewhat conserved number that is the integrated E dot B, or this is not the case?
So you mean in the quantum regime where we're not thermalizing?
Even like when you are thermalizing, like the thermal, like I think the thermal system, like still like only takes away like E dot B at a certain rate, right? And I think like that is something that was somewhat computed in like a Guy Moore's paper. That's how I understood it. So is there like another equilibrium like equation that is telling you like how does E dot B, like this integrated number, is evolving as a function of time?
So the idea here is that the reason why we can just write it in this way. So I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question 100%, but I think you're asking about the gauge fields, why we don't have an equation where that contains the gauge fields in some degree, because we know that they live in here. And the reason why we're able to just completely ignore that they're gauge fields and just write them as this radiation component is because our interaction rate is so fast. So your system is not sensitive to your radiation being made out of gauge bosons and the exact dynamics of those, at least in the thermal regime, that is true. Now, if you make this cold, then the description would.
Yeah, we can get back to this later.
When you make that cold, even for a non-abelian theory, you would start being in this regime where you look at tachyonic instabilities, and then you exactly consider the gauge fields explicitly and track their evolution explicitly. And I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, we can get back to this. We should continue.
Yeah. Okay, so this is an attractive solution. So this is quite generic, and exactly your couplings here dictate how the equilibrium temperature looks like. So now I want to contrast and compare these two. In cold inflation, we only had one scale. That was the Hubble scale that dictates the size of the anisotropies. And because we only really have the Hubble scale, the tensor to scalar ratio is fixed, and it's fixed in terms of the slow roll parameters that we have here. And those need to be small in order for our spectrum to be almost scale invariant. But now for warm inflation, and specifically, I'll be talking here about the case where the thermal friction is dominant, and I'm considering the dissipative axion friction. So what I'm saying now only applies to those specific conditions. In that case, we now have different scales, and we do no longer just scale with Hubble, but we scale with Hubble, a combination of Hubble and the temperature and the dimensionless ratio of the frictions. And what that does as a consequence, because our temperature is large and our friction is large, is that you give a huge boost to your scalar anisotropies. And as a consequence, you very strongly suppress your tensor to scalar ratio. So a generic prediction of this type of model, regardless of what specific potential you're considering, is that you're strongly suppressing the tensor to scalar ratio. And this seems to be something that's in agreement with what we have so far observed, since we have not seen a measurable one yet. And another thing that I want to point out theoretically is that now we're able to maintain our slow roll conditions for much, much steeper potentials, because now also this ratio lives in our slow roll parameters. So when people worry about your potential being too flat and you needing transplanking field excursions in order to inflate for long enough, then this is a concern that you no longer have here because you're able to slowly roll on quite steep potentials. And then another observationally interesting different thing about the warm inflation model is that in a single field cold inflation model, you predict very small non-Gaussianities, potentially non-measurable. But here you have sizable non-Gaussianities due to the presence of your thermal bath. And those are sizable in a manner that we're not yet able to measure or rule out, but we will get to that threshold within the next 5, maybe 10 years. And if we do measure sizable non-Gaussianities, as a next step, warm inflation has a unique bispectral shape that is distinct from cold inflation, even more complex cold inflation models that contain several fields or non-trivial kinetic terms. So you have a unique distinction, really, for having been warm during inflation that we may have potential to measure in the future. So now
can I stop you before you leave that slide? I'm just trying to, in the end of the day, when you put in the numbers, what kind of order of magnitude do you have in mind for the decay constant F?
You're looking at 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10 GeV, I think.
Okay, so it's well below the scales, the energies. Okay, let me think about that for a while. Thank you.
Could I also ask a question? You say unique. What shapes should we expect in this case? Unique shape or bispectrum?
So if you look at the Planck constraints on non-Gaussianities, there's this shape label which is called warm S, and it's so warm S is the shape that is unique to the system. And yeah, I'm not able to just draw it in two dimensions. It's a shape that has three-dimensional ratios, so it's probably the easiest to.
Okay, so it's not the traditional long, like a squeezed limit or equilateral or folded. It's a different one.
It's a different one. That's why it's unique. Yeah.
Okay.
So can I ask you possibly a stupid question? What happens to the glue balls? What are the dynamics of the glue balls? Because their lifetime will be a dimension 6 operator that makes them decay. You have the thermal path that's always there. So what happens to the glue balls?
So that is a very good question, and that intimately depends on how you're building your model. And I will be talking about specifically what we did, but depending on what inflation model you consider, you can ask how do you reheat? And you can either try to couple your non-abelian group to the standard model in a way where you're mostly populating the standard model through interactions in the radiation, or you can do it through glue ball decays themselves. There are many, many very interesting phenomenological implementations on what the glue balls can do. You could also choose a confinement scale such that they don't confine at all.
I see. So alpha can be really, really small.
Yeah.
If they don't confine at all. Because you say alpha is 0.1, but you can make it much smaller.
Yeah, so alpha 0.1, I said, as the upper limit. So if you go to stronger couplings, then the description here starts to break down. But you can go to smaller couplings. And your only limit there is that if you go too small, then you're no longer able to source the radiation enough.
Yeah. What is the minimum coupling that you need, alpha? Can you give us like an example parameters, I guess, for alpha F and things like that. If you just
I'm going through in a few slides. I will talk about exactly.
Okay, thanks.
So just to set that up, so are we supposed to be thinking that F, you know, is a scale that is the ultraviolet scale that you've integrated stuff out by, and so temperature has to be smaller than F, and we're in the regime where everything's happening below F. It sounds like.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But it sounds like it's also true that the Hubble scale can't be below F in the sense that, or is that right? Is it, or maybe that's wrong in the sense that the picture for generating the temperature fluctuations is a standard one, I gather. So it depends on H and on the slow roll parameters the way it normally would have, or does it also depend, does it also change? I guess maybe that's the thing that's, for me, it's behind your, the pictures of all of us. It was, so this, your top line, the top of your top formula below the box on the right, that's your formula for the power spectrum that you're going to get from your inflation. Is that right?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
And will it be true in the end of the day that the Hubble scale turns out to be below the F?
Yeah. So your Hubble scale will be very, very small.
And that's why you're getting no Planck, no tensor modes. Okay.
Yeah. That's another way of saying that.
Okay.
But so, and I wanted to say a comment about that on another slide, but maybe now is a good point. If you ask what is a viable, very low scale inflation model and how does that look like? From what I know, this is one of the, this type of model is one where you can reach extremely low scales pretty soundly. And I don't know of another model that is able to do the same thing as robust. So if you try to inflate at a very low scale, take a look at this. Okay, so now let's look at the money plot. This is the plot of the scalar to tensor ratio and the spectral tilt. And these are the constraints, the state of the art constraints that we have. And let's take a look at what we get if we consider specific potentials. So if we start out with, let's consider a simple case, m squared phi squared potential. Unfortunately, in cold inflation, this is ruled out exactly because our prediction is too large for the scalar to tensor ratio. So this is not a viable model. Now, in warm inflation, we can see exactly we get a very low scalar to tensor ratio. We're sitting almost at zero here. But now we're starting to be blue tilted instead of the red tilt that the data is showing us. And one way of understanding this is that during inflation, Hubble is slowly getting smaller versus in here, the temperature also plays an important role. And our temperature is slowly growing. Very slowly our steady state temperature. So this is why we get an opposing trend here. And if we look at another popular example, hybrid inflation, a simple, well-motivated model for cold inflation, we produce the completely wrong tilt. It's a blue tilt versus now for warm inflation, this exactly gives you the appropriate tilt. And now you may want to talk more about single field models. So if you want to consider what type of potential in a single field model exactly matches the observables here, you find that a phi to the fifth potential exactly here lies in the allowed region. You may also be able to see that I'm showing this only very faintly. The reason for that is because we found that a phi to the fifth potential was not particularly well motivated. So we're showing it here in case you're interested, but I'll be talking more now how we specifically implemented this in a hybrid warm inflation scenario. And as a reminder, in a hybrid inflation, we have two fields. We have one field, the waterfall field sigma, which drives inflation, and it's sitting at a constant energy density that's offset from zero. And then we have a second field, the inflaton field, which introduces dynamics into the system. So here, phi, rolls towards a critical value. And once it crosses the critical value, it induces a phase transition into the other field, which now rolls to its true vacuum and it oscillates and reheats into the standard model. And if you now want to modify the setup to include the warm inflation dynamics that I introduced, you put exactly in this coupling, this dissipative axiom coupling, and now the phi field is the one that's producing radiation while you're rolling towards the critical density. And then everything else stays exactly the same. There are many different ways that you can choose to reheat. You can now couple this radiation to the standard model, but the simplest, probably most minimal way is to just still couple your sigma field to reheat into the standard model directly. And then you're left over, this is the dominant energy density in the universe. So you're left over with some radiation, but to answer Mina's question, this is very subdominant. So even if these do form glue balls, you're dominated really by the energy density that's now sitting in your standard model. So it's not whatever happens to this radiation, whether it confines or it doesn't confine, it
in this specific implementation, it will not have strong consequences. And now, as promised, here are some sample parameters. And what we consider here is that we coupled the waterfall field to the standard model hypercharge. And the condition was that we need to complete reheating before Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And what we then find here is a set of sample values for your Hubble scale, your temperature scale, and your mass scale, that the energy scale of your waterfall field. That so this is a range that I'm showing here, and not every value is compatible with any other value in for everything else. Generically, what we see here is that this does give you very low scale inflation, and that you are able to span quite a wide parameter range. And I'm thinking, I'm not showing here alpha.
Sorry, what is F here? What is F?
Do you mean this F? This
FB, 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 and what is alpha B?
This is the strength of the coupling of your waterfall field to your...
Yeah, what are the values that you're taking? Because I guess the T and M sigma that you have here make some assumption also for alpha B and FB.
Yes, that's... So the condition... the condition that we imposed was that reheating needs to conclude completely before a Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and we also set FB large enough to avoid collider constraints. I do not have the exact values for those two parameters on the top of my head right now, but they're in our paper. They're listed at the bottom.
Yeah. Sorry. T now is the temperature on the phi sector.
This temperature is not the reheating temperature. This is exactly the temperature in the phi sector.
In the phi sector. Yeah, carry on. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So this concludes the second section. And as a takeaway point here, hybrid warm inflation is an appealing theoretical candidate and may be testable on a 5 to 10 year timescale through the unique bispectral shape in the non-Gaussianities. And now, a quick question about the timing. So I know we started maybe 5 minutes late, but should I stop after an hour? I'm at 53 minutes now, or?
Yeah, don't worry about the time. We started late and you had plenty of questions, so just finish.
Okay. Okay, so then this leads me to the third part of my talk. So we're slightly shifting gears now. We're looking at a different, we still keep the friction mechanism, but we're now looking at a different problem. And first I will introduce the Hubble tension, and then I will talk about how to solve the Hubble tension with the dissipative axion. So in the lambda CDM model of cosmology, it is the energy content that we have in our universe that dictates the evolution of our universe. And the different components redshift at a different rate. We can see here in the very beginning, we were radiation dominated, but radiation redshifted faster than matter. And then we went through a long period of matter domination. And now we're in a period of cosmological constant domination. And only assuming those components, this is the lambda cosmological constant cold dark matter model, cold dark matter model of cosmology. And we can measure the expansion rate of our universe that our universe is in today, directly today. And if we do that, we measure a value for the Hubble constant, which parameterizes this expansion. And we measure a value that is about 4.4 sigma larger than if we take the measurement from the cosmic microwave background. But with the cosmic microwave background, we cannot measure the Hubble constant directly. We need a model to extract the value. And the model that we're using is lambda CDM. And with that model assumption, we get this large tension. So now what I'll be talking about is the assumption that there's new physics, and in particular, something like early dark energy, and I will explain what that is. New physics that comes in before the CMB formed, and this addition to lambda CDM then raises up the deduced value of the Hubble constant and diminishes the tension. And The idea behind early dark energy, it's a model that was introduced about 1.5 years ago, and it's received a lot of attention. First, before I will dive into what early dark energy does, I will first talk briefly about how we extract the Hubble constant from the lambda CDM measurement. So what I'm showing here is again the temperature map of the CMB at the top, and we can cross that. We can plot those temperature deviations across different angular scales, and we can see very distinct features in this plot here that tell us about the properties of the fluid, of the cosmological fluid before the cosmic microwave background formed. And at the background level, the scale that's important to extract Hubble is this value here, theta star, where the first peak lies. And this theta star value is proportional to the sound horizon. The sound horizon is the furthest that sound was able to travel before recombination happens, and the Hubble constant. So the sound horizon itself, though, only depends on physics before the formation of the CMB. It's completely independent of anything afterwards. So the idea here is that we want to lower the sound horizon, and as a consequence, automatically, the value for the Hubble constant that you deduce, since theta star stays constant, increases. So the question is, what type of physics do you have to introduce to lower the sound horizon? And the answer is you have to modify the expansion history of the universe only before the formation of the CMB. So let's take a look at how this energy density would look like. What I'm showing here is the ratio of this an early dark energy type energy density over the total energy density here as a function of redshift, where Z star is the redshift at which the cosmic microwave background formed. And what we see here is that we need an energy that comes in, is completely insignificant at early times, then has a small blip that's about 6% or so, and then kind of goes away again. So we just want a small blip and modify the expansion history right before the formation of the CMB. And if you ask, okay, so what energy actually looks like that? And what I'm plotting here is the energy density in radiation and in matter. The sum of that is shown here in the red line. And then the purple line shows how this component has to behave. And this component roughly has to be a constant at very early times. So something that just looks like a cosmological constant. And due to that behavior, because everything else is redshifting, you get a distinct peak. But then after that peak, you need to dilute away like radiation or faster in order to not change the expansion history post the formation of the CMB, which is very well constrained by data. And this is a phenomenological proposal that was made that even at the perturbation level, fits the data that we have very, very well. But one issue with this phenomenological model is now, if you ask, if you want to make the leap, what type of particle actually acts like that? And let's take our favorite candidate again, let's take a rolling scalar field. You can say, okay, let's take a field, it's frozen at early times, and then it becomes unfrozen, and it oscillates, or it becomes Kanation dominated. And those were the type of models that were proposed, but the potentials that you need in order for this component to then dilute away as radiation or faster are quite fine-tuned. For example, if you consider a very simple potential, m squared phi squared, you will dilute away like matter. So to dilute away like radiation, you need to do something funky and you need to be very flat here. The question that I want to answer is how can you have this behavior naturally occurring, just emerging out of your dynamics without the need for a particular fine-tuned potential? And the idea here is that we're going to use the dissipative axion again. So again, we have a scalar field. It's slowly rolling down a potential. And we have, at early times, it's almost frozen. And now what previously was the dark energy, the early dark energy now has two components. We have the scalar field component and the radiation component. And the sum of those is what we're replacing the early dark energy with. And you can see that here in this plot as this green line. So we can see here at very early times as asymptotes to be almost exactly flat. But then roughly around the time where we basically want to have this peak, the scalar field decays rapidly. And as a consequence, the almost steady state temperature that we have here, it builds up, but eventually here it's not getting sourced anymore because our scale field decayed away. And this goes away very, very fast. So all we're left with is radiation, and that radiation now redshifts as regular radiation that is not being sourced at all. So it automatically has this behavior that you get this peak type of shape, and then it goes away. So the amount that we reduce the sound horizon by is really given by the integral under this curve. So this ratio here of this blip that we're introducing, this tells you exactly how much you're raising up your value of the Hubble constant. So in lambda CDM, your sound horizon is 145 megaparsec. And in the early dark energy model of Poulain et al., you're able to lower the sound horizon to 140 megaparsec, which raises your Hubble constant value up to 71.1 kilometer per second per megaparsec. And what we're showing here is that the dissipative axion system that I described to you within our uncertainties is able to reproduce this exact shape and is able to lower the sound horizon by the exact same amount and without requiring the use of any fine-tuned potentials. And let me see.
May I interrupt you again? So you still need to fine tune the moment when this transition happens. Am I right? So basically, this transition from slow roll to radiation should happen at same deformation, right? At last scattering, roughly, right? Is there any mechanism to adjust? I mean, to dynamically adjust that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, the original model had really, some people call it two tuning problems. One is exactly when this turns on, the other one is the potential. Here we're only really addressing the potential itself. You can consider additional model building where you try to have this more dynamically occur around this time, but this was not something we included in this work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So this was an analysis done at the background level. So at the background level, we have shown that the system exactly exhibits the characteristics that you want. For the cosmic microwave background, perturbations are important. And this is an analysis that I'm working on right now. I will say a few more sentences about that in a little bit. But really here, I can conclude the third part with saying that the dissipative axion can act like early dark energy, and you can avoid fine-tuning the potentials by including this dynamics. The outlook, oh, okay. Now I first hear a summary of what I've talked about so far. In the first part, I introduced a mechanism to produce radiation sourcing friction for a rolling axion field that is very organically able to give you a large friction and no thermal mass, which makes a lot of these models viable in the first place. And that gives you the setup for a minimal model of warm inflation that has unique observables. And this is a well-motivated particle candidate from first principles for solving the Hubble tension. And the outlook is that we're currently analyzing the system at the perturbative level using the Boltzmann-Sober class. And a very interesting aspect that we're finding is that recently early dark energy models have gotten a lot of criticism for making the sigma 8, which is the large scale structure tension, worse. The large scale structure tension is a tension that exists just within lambda CDM. The cosmic microwave background predicts more clustering than we're able to observe from direct lensing experiments today. And independently from any of this, people have shown that if you have extra radiation around during the cosmic microwave background, that you're able to diminish that tension. And our model has a unique combination of the scale field behavior that is able to address the Hubble tension, but we're also automatically injecting this extra radiation. And what we're finding right now is that tentatively, this is able to ease both tensions. So, but we're still, these are preliminary results at this stage. So stay tuned for the full results on this that hopefully will appear within the next few months. And then I've also been working on the dissipative axion as a late time dark energy. And this will come soon to the archive, probably within the next month. or so. And the highlights there is that you get a very interesting signature in the dark energy equation of state, and you potentially are able to reheat the relic neutrino background, making it easier to detect through the radiation that we're producing in this field. And this is all I wanted to tell you guys about. Thank you. And I want to invite all of you. I have an open office today at 3 p.m. I think Christina sent out the Zoom invitation, and I'm happy to chat more individually, answer questions, learn about what you're working on. And yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much. You already had a lot of questions during the talk, but is there any other pressing question or comment?
So in your model of dark energy, this radiation, this dark radiation does not interact with our, or it does, I somehow overheard that.
You mean for the last sentence that I talked about for?
No, the early dark energy one.
Yeah, in the early dark energy G1, yeah, for both the Hubble tension and inflation, we did not consider interactions between the radiation and the standard model. Mm-hmm. And those are also very severely constrained. So if you try to do anything that interacts electromagnetically around the time sensitive to the cosmic microwave background, you're almost automatically ruled out. So all of this takes place in a dark sector.
Right. So it's like an additional neutrino species, your radiation, yeah? From the viewpoint of structure formation.
Yes. And often when people talk about extra radiation, they're automatically looking at neutrinos. And one difference is that neutrinos don't self-interact, or the standard neutrinos don't self-interact, versus our radiation does have self-interaction.
I see.
May I ask a question for the second part of the talk, the early dark energy? Yeah, you need to, in general, one needs to tune the moment in which this rolling starts happening. And I guess you need to check also that if the potential was the same during inflation, that vacuum fluctuations were not moving too much that scalar field around, right?
Let me make
sure. Said in other words, you have the phi field, which is stuck in a given place, and it slowly rolls until that recombination roughly. So you had to make sure that it didn't move too much from that initial place earlier on, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Roughly, if you want to look at how does this decay roughly, you have an exponential, and in your exponential, for simplicity, if we consider an m squared phi squared potential for your field, you have the ratio m squared over your friction times Hubble. That ratio controls how fast you're rolling. And if this is much smaller than one, then you're almost nothing is happening. And then as Hubble is decreasing, you're approaching one, and that's exactly when this turns on.
Yeah, what I'm referring to, I guess, refers really to the original phase of inflation. During, let's imagine you have, by chance, high-scale inflation. You have a scalar field which is stuck in a place where the potential energy, I guess, would be roughly order electron volt, because this is when it has to start rolling down with some friction. And so there could be a clash between having high-scale inflation and having this phi field stuck there at the right place and not moving, for example, around too much.
So you're saying that this is a very interesting point. Another very interesting subtle point that we're looking into more right now is also when does your symmetry breaking happen, so to say, because this is your effective theory, this axion description. So then the question is really, as you go to higher scales, what is your UV completion and how does that look like, especially as you go into inflation? And what happens if your symmetry breaking happens during inflation or after inflation? You're right. If you want to ask how robust is it across very early times, you need to in detail look at that.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask about this model also? So what is the ineffective that you get, from this model in the CMB?
So you cannot map this radiation directly onto ineffective because ineffective assumes a radiation species that's non-interacting, and on the perturbation level that behaves differently. So you cannot directly apply the constraints. If you try to map them, onto directly, for the amount that I've shown, I think the ineffective constraints are they 0.01 to 0.02 or so that they're in this regime? You fall exactly within the like one sigma region, 1 to 2 sigma region.
Mm-hmm, I see.
So you're not yet ruled out, but as the constraints become stronger, and if you wanted to directly map it onto it, even though it's not completely doable, then you're not yet ruled out, but you maybe as the constraints get better.
But the phase shift you're saying, in the BAO oscillations in the CMB is small, you're saying, because of the self-interactions.
Yeah, and also we're not introducing a lot, right? Even at the peak, we're still at the 5% level of the total energy density. So we're not really like putting in a lot of new stuff.
Yeah, but that 5% of the total would be like an ineffective of what? I mean, right, because at this time, omega radiation is small compared to omega matter. I can't do it in my head, but okay, it's fine.
So right now in the perturbative analysis, we're doing the exact constraints exactly for this model where you don't have, where you do have rapid self-interactions, and that suppresses your shear pressure perturbations. And we're looking exactly what the consequences are for the CMB right now.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank him again. Thank you very much. That is very nice talk.